What about you? What did you want to talk about? Do you want to talk about not that you can safely f*** a cat and not get herpes? Because they have different herpes.
One in every four people, right? Is that what they say these days?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like 25%.
Yeah.
I heard someone say once that herpes is extremely common, is both true and also what you hear right before someone gives you herpes.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Discovering Darwin, a podcast dedicated to the writings and musings of Charles Darwin. My name is James Wagner, and I'm joined this episode by three esteemed colleagues. First, we'll start with Dr. Sarah Bray, Professor of Biology, Associate Dean of Chaos Control.
Yes. We our theme for this year is bridging chasms, but one time it was mistyped on something, bridging chaos, and I actually thought it was quite appropriate for this year. So, yes. Hi, friends.
Nice. Mark Jackson, professor of psychology and best dressed man in the apocalypse. How you doing, Mark?
Holding it in the road for now. So I have a question for you. Do you have any colleagues that are not esteemed?
Anybody not in this room?
Good.
All of them. And we are so pleased to have a special guest, a returning special guest, Dr. Belinda Sly, good friend and colleague and professor of biology. Hello, Belinda.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. And I'm going to be the awkward, nervous one.
No, I think that's Mark's role.
What?
Oh, it's totally my job.
Yeah.
This season for sure.
Yeah.
I'm way out of my depth.
Okay.
You have to vie for that.
But at least you're good at like talking and being clever.
Oh, I can fake my way through just about anything. I'm a psychologist. Right?
So we brought Belinda on because we're starting Descent of Man, which, as you well know, is basically, I guess, Darwin's real swan song, right? This is the big one. This is where he's going to try to finally talk about evolution of man. And we are starting with chapter one, which is the evidence of the descent of man from some lower forms. And Belinda, we asked you to join us because at some point he starts talking about this crazy thing of embryos and embryology and what they were starting to understand about sort of the evolution of early stages of life, right? But right now, I just wanted to open up the conversation to what was your thoughts of this first chapter? A reaction to reading. Now, Belinda, you haven't been reading as much Darwin as the rest of us, so lucky you. But the tone is definitely, Henrietta has earned her keep, right?
I saw that note. Will you explain to me who Henrietta is?
So Henrietta is one of Darwin's daughters, and she had helped him in editing the two previous books before this one, the previous book before this one, this book and the next book.
Okay.
I think that's right.
She didn't work on expression.
Oh, that's right.
We know that for sure.
Well, yeah. I don't want to jump the line here, but of course, my only experience has been with expressions, and I found expressions much more approachable.
Which is shocking to me.
Shocking to me as well.
Yeah.
Maybe so it's discipline.
Oh,
you know,
possibly. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right.
Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
Sarah.
So Henrietta, in our first episode of the season, she served as an editor for Darwin.
Oh, okay.
And it was really sweet. Like, he sent her this little, note and like, I want to give you a present because you were so helpful and you made it so much better. And, for James and I, but I think also for Mark at points, going through emotions was pretty painful. Read.
I honestly skipped over some parts. I didn't read every single word.
Oh, dear.
You get the gist and move on.
I have to admit, for this one, also, I could kind of like skim parts of it because I'm like, I know where he's going here. I know where he's going here. So maybe that's part of it.
So,
what do you think? How painful did you find it?
For me, it was exciting. I mean, I haven't read Darwin since I was in college. And I have not read this, and so it was refreshing and also quite humorous because I've forgotten about, the odd spellings and just the crazy way that evidence is presented. Well, this guy, as according to him, and right. you know, he told me this, and yeah, there were just parts that I found delightful, I guess I should say.
I'm going to start asking people to shoe me things.
Yes, that was my favorite, the shoe.
Oh, S-H-E-W. Yes.
I was shooing out the door.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But yes, I enjoyed it. I found it to be really easy reading.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I was struck by is that this had so many footnotes. I think I went back and compared it, and the original edition of this had 42 footnotes, but the one that we're reading has 56 footnotes. So this is a lot later edition, which was done within a year of the publication of the first one. So unlike Origin, I forgot to go back and look at the number of footnotes, but Sarah, my memory is hardly any footnotes.
In Origin?
Yeah,
Origin. Yeah, not a ton.
Yeah.
Expressions.
But there was a lot in Expressions, yeah.
Not this many, or at least based on this one chapter, I don't. But there were a bunch in Expressions.
Yeah. So there was this effort to basically really sort of support his points from using other people, right? So it's not just Charles saying this.
But it is similar to Origin in the sense that I feel like we're going to see it's like, here's just a crap ton of facts to just overwhelm you to my side. And I think, Origin got to be like, there was a certain point where we're like, this is the third chapter in a row on this topic. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll have a little of that here as well.
I'm going to read the first sentence.
Wait, real quick, because I don't have the book. I'm just looking at the digital thing you sent me. But what year was this published?
1871.
Yeah.
Oh, we're so 150th, quite a bit later.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Yeah. Thank you.
So I want to read the first sentence, and then sort of we can talk about how he sets this, thesis statement up, and then how this chapter supports it. So he writes, "He who wishes to decide whether man is the modified descendant of some pre-existing form would probably first inquire whether man varies, however slightly, in bodily structure and in mental faculties.
Or facilities.
Mental faculties. And if so, whether the variations are transmitted to his offspring in accordance with the laws which prevail with the lower animals."
So boom, two of his postulates from natural selection.
Variation?
Right there. Mm-hmm. Heritability.
And still he has no idea of genetics and
how that works.
Heritability, right.
Which is amazing.
Right.
It does.
So this chapter is entitled "The Evidence of the Descent of Man from Some Lower Form." And I wrote to you guys my problem with that sentence itself, and I was going to ask what you guys, if you want to respond to that as a title. If you were the editor for Darwin Now, and he proposed that as a chapter title, any reaction to it?
Yeah, I wouldn't use lower.
How come?
Because it's a very, and we've talked about before, chain of being kind of idea of progression, progressive evolution towards a goal. Instead of, even like I find myself, at one point in time, I feel like I used the term primitive. But I try to avoid using that kind of language
earlier.
At all.
How about earlier form?
Yeah.
Does that work?
Yeah.
But wait.
Ancestral is usually what I say.
Oh, okay. That's the word I would say. But what, can you explain why you don't like primitive anymore?
Because again, it suggests that it is
simpler,
not as evolved,
Lower.
Again, this whole idea of progressiveness to evolution, and I think that's something we talked about a little bit in the first episode for the season. Because you had a friend that was like, "Why is it descent of man, not ascent of man?"
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm.
So I totally agree with you, and I thought that was odd that he used that language. But we've talked about whether Darwin. How racist Darwin was, and in this chapter you see some of that kind of language that you're like cringe at, where he talks about civilized people having smaller jaws. That's an indication of civilization, that means. So it is odd, because we would argue that Darwin really, if you accept Darwin's ideas of evolution, right, that nothing is more evolved than anything else, right? We are as evolved as a bacterium or a Volvox.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. I was wondering where that was going.
Yes. Yeah.
Volvox.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, because everything is right at the tips of the branches.
Right.
But this lower form thing, I think, is problematic as well. Yeah, I totally agree.
And you know what I often say in class is, well, imagine us trying to live in the environment of a fish, mm-hmm. right? We would totally suck at it. We would be the lower form, you know, right. in that niche.
Yeah. Right.
But so is this just an issue for you right now of semantics, or, and again, because I don't know Darwin as intimately as the two or three of you, or does he actually, on some level, have a conceptualization of lesser and greater?
That's a good question.
I
feel like we've seen in other writings of Darwin's, he definitely does when it comes to humans.
Yeah.
Right? And mm-hmm.
But it's the lesser and greater in humans is in degree of culture. It's not.
Yeah, but I think he's still going to argue about. Really? I mean, we'll see. But I think just even some of the things that we've seen so far.
Well,
suggest,
no,
so.
You're right. Like one of the things that actually I kind of noted and wrote the word troubling, you know, in the when he's talking about the sense of smell. And again, I don't want to get too far ahead.
No, that's fine.
But he says, but the sense of smell is of extremely slight service, if any, even to the dark colored races of men, to whom it is much more highly developed than in the white and civilized races.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, he does have that great chain of being kind of thing that plays, which is, as I said, in contrast to if he accepts his own model of life, he shouldn't be doing that. But yeah, and I can't tell if it must be still part of his.
I was going to say, I think, you know, again, we have to kind of analyze it in the context of the day, like we were talking about, like this is post U.S. Civil War, you know, like all of these things. This is a very Victorian kind of point of view because, again, they're still trying to find a way to say that he, as a member of the aristocracy, belongs at a class above the others.
And white British male at that particular time. Too. You know, there are all sorts of, I've done some little, you know, Googling and looking on YouTube and stuff, and tons of YouTube videos of amateur scientists and scientists are trying to address the question, was Darwin racist? Because actually it turns out that in some like creationist arguments, they, you know, trying to undermine evolution, that's one of the arguments that they tried out.
I've seen that, yes.
Yeah. And of course the answer pretty much across the board is yes, he was, but put it in a context and, you know, how was he more or less racist than the people
everybody
that were around him? Right. And again, not to say that, you know, that absolutely the things that we will encounter and have encountered so far are problematic.
Yeah.
But.
So, dear listener, think about a bell-shaped curve. Mm. Mm-hmm. And on that x-axis along the bottom is, how racist are you? And the y-axis is, let's go poll the population and see where they are. And there's some real rare, super racist people. And there's some rare, totally enlightened, non-racist people. But most people are somewhere in the middle, right? And I guess you guys are arguing that. Go ahead.
Well, I was also going to argue that the distribution of that bell curve has probably shifted
over time.
So you have like the Victorian distribution that would put Darwin way out on the right tail, right, of the
non-racist.
But like now puts him in today into probably more the
pretty
mode.
Racist. He's pretty racist. Yeah,
yeah, that's probably a good point.
So.
Yeah.
But I have to say too that I can't imagine at this time. And if he's trying to make this point, which, you know, the whole purpose of this book is that humans descended from other organisms that were different than us, you know, most people are going to understand lower. Like, that's probably a good way of communicating with the masses, right? Which I assume, that, you know, his target, of course, was scientists, but also
I think you're absolutely right.
As well.
That's one of the things that I was thinking about is, as a communicator of science, do you make these shortcuts?
Right.
So that the
reader, I think we all do sometimes, even if it makes us cringe.
Yeah, right. Just to,
right.
Yeah.
So this chapter is trying to set the flag down. Look, you person reading this book, don't think that you're so different from other animals, lower animals, whatever that should be. And what do you guys think about, so there's a whole bunch of evidence in here, right? Mm. He starts off, I went through and looked at the book trying to identify everything, and he does bodily structure, he talks about disease, we'll come back to that, parasites. I love this idea of drunkenness, that other animals can get drunk like humans.
Hello.
Yeah. He also talks about healing and regeneration, which I'd like, Belinda, your thoughts on that. He also talks about humans and primates having what's called altricial young, that is naked and helpless young, mm-hmm. The similarity mm-hmm. there. He also talks about the sexual dimorphism in humans, males being larger than females in general. Of course, it's all a variation, and that's seen similar to other primates. He talks about embryonic development, similarity about vertebrates, mm-hmm. And on and on and on. There's a lot. And then he shifts to rudiment. So there's this homology kind of argument. Look, we're just like everybody else. Look at these kinds of things that we do, they do. We're not so special. And then he shifts the gears to the structural elements, right? And we're going to talk about rudiment versus vestigial and what do those mean. And nascent?
Nascent is the term yeah. that he uses.
And then I think... and then he ends with, I think those are the two. Is there a third kind of argument? I think it's...
No, I think you're right. I don't know why I kept turning it into three in my head, because three's a good
number.
Always make three arguments.
Three's yes. a
good number. But I think that's it. It's basically the homology argument, and then this weird, we have a bunch of rudimentary or useless structures that doesn't make any sense, but it only makes sense if you think about our bodies being modified over time.
But also wasn't one of the major points to show that, yes, indeed, there is variation.
Yeah.
Mm. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of
yeah.
at the beginning, but also
well, it's
throughout
kind of,
it.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's also kind of part of his argument about vestigial traits. That's one of the things that helps you identify them,
right.
is that they're variable.
Right.
Yeah, variable. But he does talk about, in this family, there were yeah. Five children mm. or whatever that...
But also then, hitting the heritability.
Yeah,
so it's about,
it is.
So James, you read the first line, and that does, hey, he had a thesis statement and stuck to it.
Look at that. I know.
He's been to the Rattan Center.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about, if you guys don't mind, talking about the homologous structure, what that means, and maybe it's kind of skipping ahead to embryology, because there's that argument's there, too. What is he trying to make in that argument here in the book? What did you guys get from that?
I think we should turn to our developmental
biologist. Wait. So I'm confused, because are you saying trying to define homologous structures, or are you saying trying to look at embryos?
Well, both, because in the beginning he talks about, hey, look at the hand of a mm-hmm. human, and look at the seal flipper.
Right.
And you
right.
find the same bones and the same structure.
Exactly.
And then how is that? And actually, he never makes that connection to embryology, which is interesting, right?
Right.
Which would be the real force of the argument, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
We are just starting the book.
Yeah.
That's true.
Maybe it's coming.
I think this is our one stop with embryos.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I guess this is where I'm not sure, because I just assume that you have all these fans that have listened to every single episode. So, to be told what homology is
it was 4 years ago, 5 years ago when we first discussed origin and homology.
Yeah. Right.
So it's a little rough.
Well, the classic example, and I'll be curious if you agree, you two teach evolution and I don't, but is that, yes, the limbs... of mammals are homologous, but for example, the wings of birds and bats are analogous, right? Because they evolved separately to be flying organs, essentially.
Even though they're both the four limbs.
Right. So as limbs, they're homologous, but as flying devices, right, they're analogous.
Because the bat wing is just the fingers.
Yes, it's mm-hmm. so cool. Yeah.
Right, whereas the little chicken wing, when you eat a buffalo wing, you're eating all the digits fused together. Is that right?
The very last part of the nubbin.
Yeah, the last part, the little
gross.
Pointy tail.
Yeah.
And then you're eating that, and then you're eating
the forearm,
humerus and forearm. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the little drumette is the.
Are you still a vegetarian?
No, but I'm thinking about going back. Was really disgusting.
She's like, Anthony, I don't
look, I'm a chicken.
I wish you could see.
Yeah. Hey, little buddy, I'm going to eat your arms. I'm going to eat your legs.
Oh, man.
All right. Oh, man. So he's trying to, I think one of the interesting things, he trying to get people to recognize the similarity of humans to other animals, right, mm-hmm. through those structures, as you're saying. I love the fact that he talks in there. He's referencing somebody, and he says, Bischoff, who is a hostile witness, admits that every chief fissure and fold in the brain of man has its analogy in that of the orangutan.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
He's trying to get the reader to think about humans not as this really unique, distinct structure, function, creature, but that we have similarities to other creatures. Did you guys find any interest in the arguments of parasites and diseases and drunkenness? Which right now I'm feel like
way.
I feel very, very. I have close feelings with an elephant eating fermented fruit.
Well, I enjoyed, like, he brought up just this idea of, in general, our diseases seem to be, again, yes, there's going to be some that are truly specialists, it's only humans, but in some cases, if you're more closely related, they can jump over. We're experiencing that right now in COVID times, right, of a zoonotic transfer.
And the bad ones we always get from bats.
Bastards. Oh. Yeah, no. We love bats
with
here.
With their
wings.
And altruism and social...
Yeah, allo nursing. But so one kind of case study I really like to teach in evolution is with ectoparasites and lice among humans. And so humans have three different forms of lice, right? Head lice, body lice, pubic lice.
So they're different species of lice?
Well, I'm going to put, you know, my species in quotes like we oft like to do on this show.
It's really just a difference of real estate.
Well, so there are truly two species, but the third species is, it's a real estate issue. But so it's interesting because you can look at the relatedness of, so you might expect, right, that our closest living relative are chimpanzees. So you might expect that the closest species to our lice should be chimpanzee lice, right? And that's the case for our head lice. Mm-hmm. The nearest, you know, closest related louse is the louse of chimpanzees. Awesome. Great. So, hey, what about, say, pubic lice, right? They probably, you know, maybe they evolved from our head lice, right? Like, once we stopped getting less hairy, right? Now we have different niches, real estate, right? And so maybe that derived, you know, from our head lice. No. Guess who the nearest... relative louse is to our pubic lice. Maybe some of you know.
Is it not obvious?
I wouldn't.
Is it Karen?
Is it Karen?
Who?
She's such a Karen.
Is it Karen? I don't know. Is it a paper?
No, I want to make a guess. All of us should guess. You had your guess.
Yeah, that was my guess.
So head lice closely related to chimpanzees lice. Our pubic lice, what louse is it most closely related to?
So who are we? I think is what she's asking.
Livestock.
I'm loving it. Okay, I got to go vote for livestock.
Oh my God!
Come on.
I'm gonna go with bats.
All right.
My second vote was dogs because, you know, I do sleep with my dog quite often.
Good point.
Actually, yeah. James, do you know or do you have a guess?
I do not know.
Okay. Do you have a guess?
Are you sticking with Karen?
I'm going to blame her for everything. Pubic lice. I have to go with Belinda on the livestock. That seems...
Okay.
Not that I grew up in a farm like you, Belinda.
I know.
Well, you're all wrong. Mm. The louse of the gorilla is the most closest. But to all your all's point, when I teach this in evolution, they're like, I can just see their eyes start to like, they're like, what were we doing with gorillas? But
I do find them the most attractive of the great apes.
Oh,
I mean, all I know look at those asses. They're amazing.
Well, you know, orangs are all gingers.
Yeah.
When I look at a gorilla male, I'm like, that's a dad bod. Oh, yay. Because they do have a belly. They do.
Yeah, but it's hard.
Shh, quiet.
They have that, like,
shh, it's still there.
They're more like the bear phenotype.
Give it to me. Give me the dad Bond. Anyway, Sarah, what do you...
So,
wait.
Gorillas, yeah. So,
Linkin Park, wait, I can tell he has something to say.
Yeah.
No, I'm just trying to process this. Yeah. So that is it, I mean, it's... That,
and also they diverged around the time that Australopithecines would have been around.
Okay,
if
but
that
so,
helps.
But it's not... Is it necessarily...
So we could have got...
This similarity because of...
Contact.
Contact or similarity in terms of the real estate.
I like where you're thinking. Yeah. Yeah. So the...
It's environment.
Yeah.
Where that
so
particular
the hypothesis is that we became mostly hairless. Mm-hmm. So at that point, it created this new niche. And that perhaps what we did was use, like, gorillas will make nests every night to sleep in. And perhaps what we did was we used the nest. Uh-huh. And then they hopped on. They're like, hey, here's
similar
a
real
new
estate
place. Yeah. So that's kind of a leading hypothesis. Yeah.
Okay. So, dear listener, if you want to think like Darwin, right, the first thing you would ask yourself is, going back to your point, Sarah, about being hairless, why do we keep bushes, right? Why is our pubic hair still there?
Keep bushes.
Why do we keep, right? Why
no,
do we keep
it
pubic
is
hair?
Like absolutely
why do we have like
yeah.
hairy yeah. armpits?
And why does the hair on our head grow longer than
yeah,
the other?
Right. Oh, I don't know. I'm getting pubic hairs that are super long as I get old.
Well, I always tell that they have cancer.
Oh, you're telling me I have cancer?
Well, I'm just saying, like, I used to have
pubic
this.
Hair.
Yeah.
Your pubic hairs are indicators of cancer.
For a long time, I had
you're
this hair
have to go.
growing on my arm that just would get crazy. Like, I could shut it in a door. And it is. It's like uncontrolled growth. That's what cancer is.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, I have learned from teaching developmental biology that we know so little about the mechanism of hair growth, mm-hmm. et cetera. But it, you know, the fact that...
Can you imagine your armpit hair growing as much as your
yeah,
head hair?
Yeah, exactly. Because wow. our head hair, on average, will grow for 7 years. So
before drop a
yeah,
follicle.
Yeah.
Oh, before the hair falls out.
Mm-hmm. And I've tried to look into why that is, and the only thing I can see is, you know, protection from protecting our head,
but,
right?
But
from
why want
why
not,
that long? I know.
Well, right. But also, why not sexual selection? Because it
well,
hot.
Yeah, that's definitely a
but
possibility.
But here's the other thing: as an aging man, my ear mm-hmm. hairs growing way out, like eyebrows. All of a sudden, you got these weird things mm-hmm. coming out of your eyebrow. You're like, what the heck is that?
I do get the random crazy eyebrow hair.
Yes,
which he talks about this.
Mm-hmm. He does.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah,
and because he's like pointing out that it. That happens. I do remember that, but I can't remember.
He talked about it in the ears, I think. Eyebrows. Ears. And I did comment on that because I felt like he kind of... Well, Mark, you keep going while I look at my notes.
No, I'm trying to remember, too. I mean, he talks about it in the context of, like, analogous to whiskers? Like in a cat or, you know, those...
Oh,
I don't know.
It's a sense.
Yeah. But it is interesting to think about, going back to your point, sort of pubic lice, right?
Right.
We have evolved to maintain... hair around our pubic area for a secondary reason, which would be interesting to hypothesize, mm-hmm. and then parasites, ectoparasites,
like,
take advantage of that.
Yeah, right. But, you know, and so again, it's interesting because it is a related species, like, that they came over to us, you know, from. But it's also interesting because, you know, it does allow us to kind of date when did we become hairless, because we couldn't have had pubic lice until... we became mostly hairless,
right? Mostly hairless, right.
And then same thing, then head, so we talked about head lice, we talked about pubic lice, but we also have body lice now. And with that one, it's like we had to have clothes at that point because they don't like being in the open.
Gotcha.
Right? And so we can kind of date that. And the head lice and the body lice are actually just subspecies of one another. They can interbreed. They're slightly different morphologies. But that, you know, we can then kind of date when did we really start wearing clothes. And there's interesting dating things with that, too, about New World and Old World that we don't need to get into here. But it's fun. It's just like, for me, it's like a super fun example. And so I loved that Darwin talked about ectoparasites because I'm like, yeah, now we have these new tools to think about them that really show interesting things about our evolution and when we gained
Absolutely.
And lost certain traits.
Yeah, So, James, why do we have pubic hair? Because I know you want to talk about this.
You know, I do not know, except that I think it has something to do with smell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the leading idea, yeah. right?
Is it?
Yeah.
And even in the armpits, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
so this idea of if our smell is important.
Or scent, yeah.
Our
yeah.
scent. Sorry, yeah.
Because it also doesn't come until after puberty.
Mm-hmm. He said, come.
It doesn't appear. It doesn't arrive.
12 years old.
I'm a 12-year-old boy.
Right. Yes. So you don't have it with children.
Right. So, yeah, and that's a really good point, because that would suggest it does have a function.
A sexual function.
Right.
Yeah. A reproductive function.
Right.
But, like, I mean, also, there. I don't know this literature well enough, but, you know, so there's a couple things potentially going on with the scent, right? One is there seems to be, and I bet you're familiar with these, Mark, because the psychologists that like to do this, the t-shirt studies, right?
Right.
But anyway, that show that there does seem to be a case where women tend to prefer the scent of these t-shirts that men have been wearing for like 2 months. No, not that long, but that have immune genes that are different from theirs, right? So
this preference emerges when they're ovulating.
Oh yeah, it changes. Yeah, yeah. Right. Right.
But these effects are so small, and I can't tell you how replicable these studies are. And I imagine it's not very.
Well, I think it's interesting that women show preference at all. I think that in itself is interesting. I don't know if it correlates with anything.
Okay, so again, psychologist, is it a false choice when you're like, here, Sarah, tell me which of these nasty t-shirts is the most attractive? Right? Is that not like kind of a false choice? Because you're saying, you're forcing me to say this is attractive. Or so, James, is your just argument that supposedly I'm discerning the differences?
Yeah, I think, you
can express a preference. I mean, even if none are particularly attractive, you can say this is
the least offensive.
I would pick this one, right?
I guess that's the thing that I think is just kind
of
weird.
Part of the point is that, or perhaps maybe I'm taking us off course here, is that
I don't know what our course is. We're always on course.
There are decades of research about this that, you know, oftentimes our conscious choices aren't... We're unaware of the real motivation behind our conscious choices, and that we can provide a rationale for I picked this one because, you know, I like the way it looks, or this one seems cleaner, or whatever. But you know, stepping back and looking at the similar choice from an array of options for multiple people, and you see this clear pattern that shows, oh, actually, this is a primacy effect, right? People tend to choose the first one that they see,
right?
But, you know, that kind of thing. And you know, we're unaware of it, but we convince ourselves,
because we're unaware,
we create a reason for ourselves why we like this. Yeah. So again, you know, just to
but I also think there's a chicken and egg kind of element to it, because all of us having a significant other enjoy their smell, right? Not the perfume. No, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. So you snuggle up to them and you're like, oh, I like that. And the question is, is it because I associate that smell with them,
right,
and therefore I like that smell because I like them? Or did I, you know, I mean, could you imagine hanging out with someone that just, you're like, oh my God, that you stink, dude. Dudette. I mean, I'm just sorry, you know. You got to go bathe yourself in perfume. I wonder about that, because we do detect the smell of others and our significant others, and we like it often. Mm-hmm. And now, is it a Pavlov conditioning kind of thing, or did it actually, I threw out a bunch of potential mates because
they didn't like
the way they smelled?
Well, I don't know. I'm certainly not.
You don't know what they smelled like. And so I have no idea how to.
I'm not quite so convinced of the whole, you know, pheromone. We certainly can associate particular smells like we would associate anything, you know, with a person and pleasurable feelings and stuff. And so we come to appreciate that particular aroma. And that would be tied to, in the example that you're giving, sort of perfumes or soaps or something like that. But I'm not so sure that, and again, I don't know about the research, that like everybody has as unique a personality, they also have a unique aroma that is emitted from them that you can pick out of a lineup. I don't know that that's the case.
Well, do you think that's because of modern culture with all the perfumes and shampoos? But 10,000 years ago, yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to stake my claim on this, but I do feel like there's enough research of variability in microbiomes on skin that those bacteria would be producing different secondary. So I think, I think we probably all do have a set profile.
Well,
whether or not we detect it.
He tells us that our sense of smell is pretty lame over the years. So that we can detect those subtle differences I don't know.
But of course,
go ahead.
Oh, of course, we just can't help, or I can't help but point out that, you know, I'm guessing a majority of women in this country don't have armpit hair anymore.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And how has that changed whatever function that may have had?
Well, you mean
and,
they're like, because they shave it
yes.
off?
Yes. Mm. Yeah. Well, okay. And I mean,
you mean in America?
We can even go pubic
those
hair.
French women, exactly. Those French women.
Yeah, right, right. That's why I'm clearly not saying everyone, but there's definitely been a shift.
Yeah,
I
also, American women are pretty much depiliated.
Yes.
I find that very creepy.
Yes.
The fact that that's, I mean, when you really think about it, it's like, you should look prepubescent. It's a little disturbing.
It is. That's but was it not in this reading? I'm embarrassed. I can't remember, but I know that pubic hair has been thought to kind of give a and Mark,
you teach human sexuality.
Okay, good. There's
or
the reason
not
why
saying he's a deviant,
or kind of during sex, it can kind of like make it less painful.
Oh,
I don't know necessarily about
like
the
a cushion.
Yeah, a cushion. That's the word. A cushion. And also, I remember once a friend that went to the doctor who, of course, you know, she shaved and her OBGYN was like, you shouldn't do that. You can get ingrown hairs. And it's more likely to transmit diseases if you don't have pubic hair. Hmm. But that was just an OBGYN. Right. She may have been like, not I'm saying just like, she just may have been expressing her opinion.
We do both men and women have.
Really?
This layer of fat above the pubic bone. So the mons veneris is what it's called for women. Fat. And for men, it's, I love it, it's the prepubic fat pad.
Oh,
not sexier name. Not post-pubic?
Nope.
Yeah. Well, because in front of.
It's in front of.
Oh, yeah. Right. I'm thinking puberty. I'm thinking, no, it'd show up post-puberty.
For the pubic, pubic bone.
Pubic. That's the bourbon talking. All right, so wait.
I love, we have gone seriously down a rabbit hole here.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm living the conversation, but like, I kind of don't remember why we got here.
Well, because
Darwin. Okay, we're here Darwin. For Darwin.
Oh, we are?
So here's why, because Darwin says, the sense of smell is of the highest importance to the greater number of mammals. To some, as in the ruminants, in warning them of danger. To others, as the carnivora, in finding their prey. To others, again, as the wild boar, for both purposes combined. But the sense of smell is of extremely slight service, if any, even to the dark-colored races of men, in whom it is much more highly developed than in the white and civilized races. So,
for starters, what is he basing that on?
Yeah. He doesn't really, like, provide... That, it's interesting that he doesn't. I don't recall him being like, and I cite General Ford.
Oh, right. No, he does. He does 36. No, he does. Oh, on this one, he says, the account given by Humboldt of the power of smell possessed by the natives of South America is well known. It's well known, you guys.
Well, okay,
I'm sorry.
Obviously.
It's well known.
That's all you need.
And has been confirmed by others. So shut your mouth.
That makes it true.
No, but here's the thing.
Yeah.
Two things. It seems to me the classic argument that he is making here, even that humans have a poor sense of smell, has often been argued, I think, structurally, because the number of nerves we have in our olfactory is much less than you see in dogs and other animals. And so the classic argument is, therefore, we are less sensitive than, say, a bloodhound or a dog. I think others have made the argument that that's not quite true, because there's people who can drink a wine and say it's from this area in France. And there's people who can really discern different flavors and perfumes and smells. And one argument has been made that actually the number of nerves doesn't talk about the processing power, the brain power that, that goes on. And that humans with training have the ability to be as discerning as other.
Like, seriously, though? Well, like, as a dog? Cause,
no,
I
no,
mean,
no, not as a dog.
Okay.
It certainly is a skill that can be... developed,
yes.
Okay.
With a lot of work and a lot of practice.
Right.
There are individual differences. There are, you know, people that are designated or identified as super tasters.
Right.
Right.
I'm sure you've heard them before.
Mostly being a super smeller, right? Because so much of our
taste
is based on smell.
It's both. Yeah. It's both.
I thought you said speller. Yeah. I was really struggling with that. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, the olfactory gene clusters are pretty amazing, and that you look at the number of olfactory receptors that dogs have. I can't remember off the top of my head if it's like 800, some, you know, above that, whereas humans, it's, you know, much,
couple
much
hundred,
lower.
I think, yeah.
So it really is like we do not have proteins that will
trigger,
right, exactly. So, yeah, you know, I think that,
but do you think, I'm sorry to interrupt you, no, but do you think it's a, is it a level of diversity or is it a level of concentration? Like dogs can detect at lower concentrations, humans might require a higher concentration, but they would detect the same thing. You know what I'm saying?
No, because so, they like don't have the actual receptors.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking if it's
structures, right?
It, yeah,
humans they don't.
Well, that's right, the question I'm having, because it, you,
yeah,
could, you could imagine if you had a lot more of the same structures listening in, you could pick up a weaker signal.
But it's different. Like these
totally
genes
different.
Actually, you know, they make proteins that have different structures than any we have.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So but the vocabulary, I mean, of smell is much broader.
Right.
It's like certain organisms that can see into the infrared and ultraviolet spectrum.
Yes, that's a beautiful.
All right. So the other thing I was thinking about is that I was reading a book where the author was talking about in Africa, he was with native Africans, and they would smell a dead carcass, right? Hmm. We seem to have a very high sensitivity to the smell of rotting flesh.
Makes sense.
Right? Yeah. But what's interesting is that those people, the Africans in the plains that he was with. The Africans, not him. Yeah, those people is not meant to be a judgmental thing. But they would follow that smell to get to the carcass. Why? Because they like to eat it.
Yeah.
And he was repulsed by the smell. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's funny because we typically go, oh, yeah, we're evolved to repulse the smell of rotting flesh because of bacteria and disease and stuff, whereas that may not be true because there are people who eat that because it's like the old, when you used to hunt partridges, you would hang them by their neck on your front porch, and when they rotted through and fell off the string, that's when they were ready to be eaten. I know Sarah's got a great face.
No, thank you.
But we talk about aged beef. What is aged beef? It's rotting beef in a cooler.
Mm-hmm.
But it is rotting beef. So it's my point being is that things that we as civilized people find repulsive may not have been evolutionarily the same things or not responded in the same way, I guess, which I think is really hard for us to parse when he's writing about dark-colored races of men have a higher sensitivity.
Yeah, but I think that comes back to the training issue, right? So there's not like an actual baseline difference in our ability to detect scents. It's this like training to know like this scent means X and I like X or I don't like X.
It's signal detection.
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's all signal detection.
I mean, the one thing that I did like about when he was talking about scent and smell was the link to memory and how strong that
is. I was just thinking that. And that suggests, too, then, that a smell could have different meaning to you over time.
Yeah.
And we all know that.
This is a personal anecdote, and it's bizarre. But I studied as an undergrad in Costa Rica for a semester. And so, like, I spent 2 months in San Jose, Costa Rica, and then 2 months, like, in the field doing field work. But to this day, just from my experience of being in San Jose, where there's a lot of buses, a lot of diesel cars, I get the smell of diesel and I think of Costa Rica, which seems like the bizarrest link. Yep.
Fresh baked bread for me, San Jose, in Costa Rica.
Yeah.
You smell that bread in the morning and you're like, oh, I'm right there.
So two people associating a place with very, very different smells, right? Yeah.
That is interesting that our brain would map that sensory signal with a memory.
Yeah. It has to do with the position, and maybe Mark, you can help me because it's been a long time since I've looked at this, but the position of those proteins, those receptors, and where they map into the brain, right? The olfactory.
Which also that olfactory nerve goes straight to the brain, right?
And specifically to where memories are formed.
Right.
I mean, so especially I don't think anything triggers such strong nostalgia as a smell.
Like, and again, maybe none of us in this room know the answer to this, so that's fine. But considering that brains are homologous structures, is that a uniquely human trait that is connected to memory?
That's a good question.
I mean, there's all these, like, I don't know if you know, like for like, Mark, you know all things of any kind of psychological study ever.
Yes.
But right, like.
I'm your token psychologist.
Like, there's all these things with, like, mice and rat studies, and there's like they do a lot of smell recognition, don't they? Like they associate memories. So well, I don't think it's unique.
Lab rats are bred to be weirdos. Blind.
Yeah.
Yeah. They don't have vision.
Oh, right.
Very much. So that's their other.
Okay, so they have to. Yeah.
So, like,
so that's another.
The daredevil. They're like super attuned to
other
senses.
Such a really fascinating thing to think about. I mean, you know, clearly because we're so close to dogs, we always think about them, that, you know, they probably our smell more than anything that they're responding to, et cetera. But I guess we don't really know about memories and antelopes. And
did you say antelopes?
I did. He says antelopes at some point in here, right? Didn't he?
I don't remember the antelope.
No, it was in something else I looked at. And that will go back to the embryology section, so I'll save it for later.
Take a break.
Yeah, I was just thinking that we should.
This is good.
Because you know
take
what?
A break, because and we're going to come back and talk about embryos.
Turn it over to Belinda.
Right. Yeah, turn it over to Belinda. We can just drink.
Yeah.
Sounds perfect.
I'm sorry. I feel like we got so off topic.
Welcome to our world.
Okay, so no it's not me.
We have no topic.
Okay,
really.
Because I could talk about hair, especially pubes, forever.
It's pretty crazy.
Poor Dave.
But can you get into the lice like Sarah did?
Yes.
Because that's where it gets sexy.
No, I mean, seriously.
And I tried to hold myself back.
All right, you all. You're listening to Discovering Darwin, and we'll be right back.
I got lice today somehow. My mom is gonna have a cow. I got lice today, oh my. I have no idea how or why. I may have used Sam's comb at lunch and hugged my friends and classmates a bunch. I borrowed a helmet to ride my bike and used someone's towel to get me dry. How did this happen? What did I do? I've got a head full of lice and I'm feeling so blue. All those things I shouldn't have shared. Now I've got a whole bunch of lice.
Welcome back. Hair. You're listening to Discovering Darwin. This week we are discussing chapter one of Descent of Man, and we have a special guest, Belinda Sly, with us today, who we are going to impose upon her expertise in this next section as we talk about embryos.
What do you want to know?
Well, you know, the thing that's interesting, and there's a new book that just came out about Descent of Man. I forgot what the title is. I'll put it in the show notes. But they, in the front piece of this book that we're reading, criticizes Darwin for not talking about fossils of early humans, which I think is an unfair criticism, because I looked up and the only fossils weren't found by the time this book was published was two skull caps of Neanderthals. So that seems like but Darwin focused and leaned, it seems, heavily on embryos and this whole idea. What, Belinda, can you explain to us why would this be a very good, compelling argument? And what were they actually trying to illustrate?
Well, I feel like I can turn it back on you a little bit. And that I feel like in the origin, didn't he talk some about like barnacles and their larvae looking similar to other marine invertebrates? I mean, didn't he have an early appreciation?
He may have, but we don't care about embryos like you do, and we probably forgot.
Oh.
Well, we definitely did.
So. So I was thinking that he did have an appreciation for, I mean, if you think about mollusks, et cetera, they have these crazy divergent larvae, embryos and larvae, and that look completely different than the adult form. And I believe that he did talk about that. It's like maybe you can look.
Barnacles are arthropods.
That's right. Sorry. That's right. I do know that. But arthropods also have some crazy larvae as well.
And I think maybe that's exactly why he was able to say they weren't mollusks.
Yeah, it was because of the larvae. I'm thinking about all of that stuff. So anyway, I love that, you know, he was able to look at those organisms and notice that they're you know, developmental forms could look very different than their adult forms. What was your original question? Why is he interested in embryos? Or
do you have a sense of so Darwin's writing this in 1870, and now people are starting to actually, the microscope is invented, right? Mm-hmm. So now we can look at very tiny things.
Exactly.
And some people are starting to actually look at embryos of different animals.
Right. Absolutely.
And humans, which seems pretty crazy. Like, how did they get those embryos?
I know. Well, you know, the Von Baer is mentioned just very briefly in this chapter. And Von Baer was the first person that we know of that described the mammalian egg. And you can imagine what a big deal that was, right? Because all these other things that people have been looking at of external fertilization, right?
Was the homunculus, right? The sperm. There was a little man in the sperm.
Yes, absolutely.
Women gave nothing.
Yes, yes. it is interesting. This is just a little side note, but Von Baer, depends on the source you look at, and I wonder how much you guys come across this since you've been looking at this old literature where you hear one story in one place and another story. But the first time I heard that Von Baer discovered the dog egg by dissecting his own dog, now I recently heard it was his what we would call a PI, principal investigator. But I still haven't found, like, if he killed the dog or if, you know, he dissected it. But anyway, so I believe that was like 1820, somewhere around there. So that would have been, you know, really the first identification of the ovum, right? And so...
So wait, sorry. How is that shocking when you've got chickens and eggs? Like, it was just like, oh my gosh, mammals have the same thing that birds have with an egg? Was it such a dramatic change of mind?
Get to them, right? Because they're inside of a organ. They're not laying.
I mean, it was predicted that it was there. People had this idea for sure, but it still was a pretty major discovery, right, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But you can imagine that... Yeah, it's very invasive, just like in any mammal, to be able to get an embryo. It's incredibly invasive. And so, yeah, it is interesting to think.
Is that a polite way to say lethal?
It doesn't have to be lethal, but...
Weren't early pregnancy tests, like you had to kill a rabbit to do it?
Oh, for the immune response, yeah.
Yeah.
There also was peeing on frogs.
It's a MASH episode with that.
On frogs?
Peeing on tadpoles to see if they'd metamorphose.
Oh. Ooh.
Yeah. Isn't that cool? Like that hormone, the gonadotropin-releasing hormone. I feel like I'm probably going to say some wrong things here, and people are going to get mad at me. But
no one gets mad at you. But that goes back to Darwin's argument about... convergence or similarity.
Absolutely.
Why would a human's hormones? Oh, yeah.
Homology. Right. It might be a different function, but you know they recognize it. Absolutely. So, where was I going? Oh, anyway, yeah. It's been very hard to study mammalian development because of the fact that early development is embedded inside of a uterus, and it needs to be there, right? Although I'm sure we're going to have artificial wombs before too long. But
so wait. Whoa. Now I'm just curious.
Like, yeah.
When can we actually extract a mammalian embryo and look at it before? I don't know. Yeah. When you just said it has to be embedded. I mean, I think I know that, but then that just made me be like, oh, we can look at them. We're just killing them. We just can't continue to have them grow.
Right. So, okay. I mean, we've got in vitro fertilization, and they keep extending how long you can keep an embryo alive in a petri dish. But really, truly, it's like about gastrulation. It needs to be digging into the uterine lining, forming the placenta, et cetera.
So these are words that you're comfortable with, but our listeners may not be.
Uterus?
Gastrulation, and et cetera. So in vitro fertilization, right, they get the egg and sperm and in a dish.
Right.
And they, like, put them together. They get a fertilization event. At what point are you saying... How late can they let this thing develop? They're not putting a little, like the drawing in this book.
No, right. So
or Texas 6 weeks.
Right. Right. So normally when we're seeing pictures of something from, you know, a clinic, it's a blastula stage, which it's essentially a ball of cells with a hollowed out middle. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's at that stage usually that people might like pull off a cell or, you know, maybe the 8-stage embryo and pull off a cell to analyze it, whatever. But once we get to, now they really have extended this, but typically 7-8 days, that's when the embryo hatches. So we actually do hatch just like a chicken. So we have this thing called a chorion, and you know that keeps the embryo from embedding in the fallopian tubes, which is a bad thing, right? That's an ectopic pregnancy. When the embryo gets all the way to the uterus, it hatches. So it releases these enzymes that digest through the chorion, and it's amazing. It's like squeezes out of this little hole, and then it's getting ready to undergo what some consider the most important stage of our life.
Implant.
Gastrulation. Gastrulation. Oh. Which,
so it's not prom.
It's not prom. I know.
I have to reevaluate my entire life.
Exactly.
Wait, but is gastrulation implantation? That's different.
That's different. Mm-hmm. So it's basically.
Is it before?
It's really gastrulation is starting at the time of implantation, and so what is happening at that stage is all of the external cells start diving into this hole. And as they're diving into that hole, they start taking an identity. And really, this is when the three germ layers are formed. So ectoderm, mesoderm, and endoderm, which give rise to various organs. So, in fact, some people, when they consider that when does life begin, you know, some people say gastrulation because that's when you're, like, getting differentiation of tissues. But still, we're only talking about, you know,
a ball of cells.
Yeah, exactly.
And for us, that's an anus.
Yes, that's right. The first hole is the anus, the most important hole in our bodies.
And so, and I think I remember reading somewhere like 70% of pregnancies fail up to this point.
Right? Absolutely. So absolutely.
It's not a guaranteed deal.
When you know, when I teach developmental biology, I always come away with this, how are any of us alive? You know, how does this, it's like, you know, we spend so much of our lives worried about getting pregnant, or at least I did. You know, then you realize that actually we should be more concerned about ever getting
pregnant.
That's
okay. James said to a bunch of college first years that the first time doesn't count. There's no way you're going to get
pregnant.
That's
not exactly what I said. No.
That's the legend, though.
God, yeah.
I technically said, let's not even go there.
Wow.
Because it'll be a mess and I can't clean it up.
Oh.
But yeah.
The gastrulay, which is kind of an early term, so an embryo that's in the process of gastrulating, is incredibly similar throughout all animals.
Right. You could not, if I gave you one, you wouldn't tell me it's an ape, a dog, a cat, or a fish.
Well, it is hard to say, I mean, because there are some fundamental differences. Like, you know, in a chicken, gastrulation is taking place on top of this yolk. And so it's essentially a sheet of cells, which is pretty amazing. Whereas in mammals, it's a ball of cells. So I hate to say that you couldn't differentiate, but in terms of what is happening and the mechanism, it is incredibly similar.
But that's because chickens don't have a placenta, right? So they have a yolk.
Yeah. How
about this? Then if I go, I show you early stage of a bunch of mammals, could you tell the difference?
Right. So, no. I mean, and that's where it's, you know, I could easily show an image of a mouse gastrula and you know, it'd be, unless you were an expert, I wouldn't be able to tell the difference between a mouse and an embryo.
I just saw a meme this week of a little embryo and saying, this is a, you know, 6 week old embryo.
Oh, I know where this is going.
And then it was an elephant embryo.
Yeah.
And they were like, calm down. You can't even tell.
Exactly. So there are so many similarities. And that's where, because he does mention Von Baer, I did want to talk just a little bit about who that is. So he, of course, was one of these dudes. He was German. I don't know where that.
So many German dudes.
Yeah.
So many.
Well, that, you know, it's just, as I'm sure you've talked about, you know, there was all these scientists that did so many different things. Mm. Right. But very much was an embryologist and, you know, and just careful observing of development. And so he came up with Von Baer's laws, and there's four of them, and I feel like they're almost said very redundant, which is redundant itself. but essentially, more general characteristics develop first, more specific later on. Okay. Right. And that had an impact on Darwin's thinking, for sure. He was aware of von Baer's work, and that did have a big influence on him, at least from what I've read. So, and then, I don't know how much you want to go into this.
Just go.
It did, you know, that kind of work led to this idea of we can learn a lot about evolution by looking at development.
What is your? I know this is going to be like conjecture, but imagine these scientists at this time period, right? Early 1800s, right? I think.
Yeah.
And there's the here they pull out and look at an embryo of a dog, and they look at an embryo of a human, and they look at an embryo.
I know.
And they're like, "What the hell?"
Yeah.
Were they shocked at how similar all these things were?
I'm going to say yes. I mean, I would have to think so. I mean, I'm shocked still to this day, you know, when you look at them. I mean, even looking at a dolphin embryo and an elephant embryo, I mean, it's just amazing, right? And but Sarah mentioned this to me the other day, and so I feel like maybe it's worth mentioning that, you know, in the same field of early embryology came Haeckel's work. Right, which, you know, he became famous for these beautiful drawings did. But of course, you know, it was a very early on recognized that he was a little loosey-goosey with his drawings and made them look more similar. So it was everything from fish to salamanders, you know, on and on. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, yeah. My question, though, is because I don't really know as well the history. I know a little bit about the controversy. Was it that he was intentionally making these more similar, or was, in essence, the technology being able to see them?
Yeah. You know, so as I learned more about him as a person, he was, it kind of seems like it probably was the former.
Oh, really?
That he was like, you know,
he had an agenda.
He had an agenda, which, well, okay, no. So, interestingly, oh, I shouldn't clap. That's probably loud.
I'll start recording right there.
Yeah. Yeah, Haeckel very much, even though those drawings did come out after On the Origin, was not a supporter of natural selection. Anyway, Mark, what did you say? Oh, yes. Yeah, so Haeckel was known as kind of a, I'm trying to think of what the word would be, bullshit.
No.
Yeah, maybe.
Really?
So his Wikipedia page says he was a flamboyant figure who sometimes took great non-scientific leaps from available evidence.
See, flamboyant is pretty broad.
You yeah, know. I know. So, like, exactly.
James to be flamboyant with his bowling shirts.
Right. So, and then, of course, you know, he really became a racist. Eugenics, et cetera. So, it is like when I first started learning about this stuff, it was this idea that, oh, it was no, you know, it's not until now when we have better technology that we were able to see that these weren't correct. But upon further research, you know, I've seen that even his contemporaries were saying, hey, this is a little shady.
Much. Yeah, okay.
Which unfortunately then creationists have latched on again.
Yes, and said, of course.
Like, all you evolutionists just fake this stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
But is it not, correct me if I'm wrong, but is it not that what Haeckel did, he didn't clarify at what stage in development they were at. And so you could actually see similarities across vertebrates, but they were at different periods of time.
No, he actually had misrepresentations of like how many pharyngeal arches there were.
It was really structural differences.
It was.
But we do see similarities in the developmental stages.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
So we as a human have, correct me, please, if I'm wrong, but we have gills at some point.
Yes.
In early development.
Absolutely.
We have a cloaca.
Yes.
Your favorite word.
Yes.
Laura? We'll come back to that.
Yes.
We have a tail, a post-anal
Absolutely.
Tail.
Absolutely. So, and I'm glad you're bringing me there because I was going to just keep blabbing. But I will say really quick, so those observations led Haeckel to start talking about ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny.
Oh, those are $10 words.
Big words.
I know.
So can you repeat them and then break them down for us?
Ontogeny, which is development, recapitulates phylogeny, which is essentially evolution. So that idea...
And recapitulate just means to echo back.
Right, right. Okay. And the idea then was that, so a mammal is at one point in development going to be a fish, and then the next stage going to be a frog. Right, so it is actually, an echo of its ancestry. And whereas Von Baer had said, no, I mean, and this was way before, right? He's saying simply everything starts off more general. So, of course, more animals are going to look alike when they're early, and then they differentiate as they grow, and so then they start. Oh, yeah, that's a good picture.
Yeah.
Richardson did this great picture, I believe, in the 90s, where
he
went back.
Share this on the website.
Go ahead. Yes, thank you. We'll share this on the website.
That's a very personal way to say it.
Yeah. That where he actually took photographs of these different organisms, and it's beautiful. You definitely should check it out.
So, what Darwin is putting down in this book, 1870, is still right.
Yeah,
even though
absolutely.
Hegel maybe took some artistic license to that idea.
Not scientific license.
Yeah, because he really was trying to say that, you know, like we have a fish stage in our life. Like we were fish in our embryonic stage.
And then reptile, then mammal.
Right, exactly. And and that is not actually the case. So it turns out that Von Baer, who was many 50 years before or whatever, was
more correct
in the way that he presented this.
So what do you think about the drawings that he puts in this book itself? Have you had a chance to look at
them? Well, I didn't look that closely at them, to be honest.
So he has a human embryo and a dog.
And a dog. And what do you think? What do you see?
I think it's really poorly drawn. It's a wood print.
It's a wood, yeah.
Right.
Nubbins. Lots of nubbins.
Nubbins, and there's a bunch of letters, and I'm convinced of a couple of things. I'm convinced of the tail.
Yep.
I'm convinced of...
limb nubbins.
Yeah. But other than that, it's really not so well.
Eyeball.
But today, if we had embryo drawings, what would you... why would you show them, Belinda? What are you trying to...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, in developmental biology, as I'm sure all developmental biologists show in class, you know, they do show these stages. And, you know, oftentimes it's a mouse that we're using to demonstrate some developmental stage. But, you know, unless you work very closely on that stage, you would not recognize the difference between...
So why did they... I mean, so... the argument ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny is this idea that we go through stages of our earlier ancestral states. And you agreed with me when I said we have gill slits. We have
That's where I felt like we should come back to is that when we look at development, we can see these vestigial organs or tissues, etc. And so, yes, the gill slits is a perfect example. The post-anal tail, right, is another really good example. And it doesn't mean that our embryo is actually, like, representing, like, oh, it's going through the fish stage or, you know, whatever it is. It's just that the early development is following the same program, right? There's been divergence in the body plan that leads to the adult, but very early on, because you're working with such general stages, you know, they're very similar. But as they start getting older, they're becoming, the features are more specific to that specific animal. And so for us, not having a tail is something specific to us, right? And so that feature of being tailless comes later in development. And then, of course, you know, the limb buds and dolphins and whales that you see in the embryo is another just beautiful example of saying, yeah, look, we have a common... their ancestor was walking on land, right? Did have hind limbs,
and humans are born with tails, right? To this day.
To this day.
Some individuals.
Yes.
Oh, right.
Not on
like,
the whole.
No, not on the whole, but yeah, right. The variation there.
Exactly.
James just revealed something.
I know.
Right? Yeah. Humans are born with tails.
Right. They cut them, but they do cut them off on newborn babies, right?
Right, right. Occasionally. Anyway.
So what do you think about the use of embryos as an argument about human evolution, that we are similar to other animals.
It's beautiful.
You think it's
it's incredibly powerful evidence that has only gotten stronger with the advent of genetics. And of course, you know I'm going to say it, but my field, truly Evo Devo, right? Which really made that its appearance, I guess, 90s, right? Late 80s, 90s, when people started saying, hey, let's look at genetics and development and see what we can learn about evolution.
So I'm going to ask you a question that may or may not stay in the podcast.
Okay.
Okay, so just feel comfortable with that, and you can tell me how.
Should I clap?
You
do you want me to clap?
Yeah, go ahead and clap. Nice. All right, so here's the question. So Texas, new law, six weeks.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, Carl Sagan wrote a beautiful essay about, you know, what do we do? You would not take a baby coming out of the, you know, at birth and hit it with a hammer and go, boom, it's
dead.
Well,
some people would.
Okay, but
no. I'm not saying some people. I mean, I'm even saying there have been cultures that. Right?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Certain cultures, you can birth a twin.
Yeah.
You got to let one go because you try to sustain both. One of them's going to die. They're both going to die.
Okay.
Yeah. So sorry.
No. That's a good point.
Yeah.
But so you know, as a developmental biologist, what do you think about this whole argument about like viability and embryos and heartbeats? We've got people who are mentally dead, right? Mm-hmm. And they have a heartbeat in the hospital and we can pull the plug.
Absolutely.
And yet we flip the argument and say this ball of cells that a heartbeat, no brain, we have to keep.
Exactly.
Obviously that doesn't seem to make sense. But
I know.
Do you mind?
I want
to hear anybody.
Yeah.
I'm just saying you're trying to make an argument on in an avenue that is not really where that kind of law is coming from. You know what I'm saying? It's not about life. It's not about
evidence, logic,
science.
It's about control in
right.
the end. Because you know, particularly, and I may be slightly mistaken, but my understanding is that their definition of 6 weeks is not 6 weeks from conception.
Yeah, no.
It's 6 weeks from your last menstruation. That's the time
so it's
criteria.
Really like 4 weeks,
which
the vast majority of women don't know they're pregnant.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
not this heartbeat bill. It's 6 weeks.
No.
Anyway.
It is appalling.
Yeah.
It is. And, the statistics I've seen, you know, over 50% of fertilized embryos, probably much more than that, are not viable.
Right.
Right.
I heard 70% when you get to the, you know, all the way to the implantation. And
when they have been able to do studies where they get the tissue, which of course is very hard, right? Because it's almost nothing, right? But they do chromosomal analysis. You know, so many of them do actually have chromosomal abnormalities. So that's a very common occurrence.
So do you think our definition of a viable human will change with technology? Or do you think the current model that we have right now is like, that's what we should do?
Viable human, it's not even,
what
it's
is
not
the model?
Scientific. Yeah, yeah, like I don't think there is a model, right?
I know.
No, there is right now. We've said you can't abort a fetus after 23 months.
But unless it's not, though.
23 like months. You got up until they're two. To change
you're
your mind.
Elephant.
You
know what?
You got to keep your receipts, though. No, you can't exchange them without your receipts.
There are some cultures, actually, Mark, that you're not a person until you're 5 years old.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. Hunter-gatherer groups. No, yeah. I think
still question my own personhood from time to time.
I know.
And I'm well over 24 months.
But, yes, I do think technology could change us. I mean, because, you know, you think about, like, what was it, the Million Snowflakes Project, I believe that's what it called it, George Bush talked about, where, his idea was that all of the frozen embryos in the United States should be...
Find a uterus.
Right?
There's thousands of children right now who need a home. Why would we care about...
I know.
Eggs in a freezer.
Blastulas. Yes.
Oh, sorry. Blastulas in a freezer.
Right. Exactly. But you could, I'm sure there's some people who even want to save the eggs. But, you know, we can let sperm go everywhere.
Yeah. Well, just in socks. I I have no idea where we are right now, folks. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll wrap up this chapter.
Okay.
Whatever you're listening to, it's not Discovering Darwin. So don't blame us. Welcome back to Discovering Darwin. We are talking about our failure to control our bodies. And in fact, that's one of the things Darwin talks about, right? The ability for some people to control their scalp movement and their ear movement. And we all can move our eyebrows, right? And so there is a series of muscles we have under our ectoderm, the panniculus carnosus. That's what it's called? Yeah, Belinda's laughing at me.
No, I don't.
Well, I have it right here.
Yes.
Yeah.
But not clearly not phonetically.
Not phonetically, no. Anyway, panniculus carnosus, and that's why I never went to med school, because I could never say these words. But the point is, there's a series of muscles right under our skin to move our skin. Humans have a very restricted use of those muscles. Like, we can move our eyebrows, and we've talked about it in the expression mm-hmm. of humans, right? The need to communicate with others. But some humans...
And there are aspects of that movement that we can consciously control and some that we can't.
Oh, ooh, wow.
Right? That, you know, that the whole... You know, and that's where those micro-expressions come into play. Gotcha. You experience a surge of fear, and you get eyebrows that raise and knit together, and it's something that very few people can do consciously.
On control.
Yeah, like, controlled.
Show me your fear eyebrows.
I can't. Because I'm not one of those people.
But we can all move our eyebrows on control. But can you move the scalp, right? And or your ears? And watching Belinda go like she's having a stroke right now. She tries to control.
I can't do anything cool with my body.
But Darwin talks about a family that can like throw books from their head because they can flick the scalp so fast and rapidly.
He makes it sound like they're throwing books.
Right,
I think they're just sort of knocking them off their heads. Right. They're just sort of like give them a little.
But the
shiver.
Point is that they can put a book on their head, and they have enough
stack
control
of
the muscles of their scalp that they can flick their scalp forward, and the book flies off. It's a great superpower.
It
right?
is the lamest superpower.
But I mean, dear listener, right now, can you twitch your ears like Sarah can? Sarah?
Okay, I gotta like.
Should we get some
this
video?
This is exactly
of this?
What podcast listeners want to hear. Yes. Wait,
it's amazing. It looks so cute.
Oh my God. She's like an elf.
Yeah, and my dad can do it too. So.
Just, oh, yeah. So
it's
there
terrible.
Is. So
well, N of one, N of two. N of two.
Right.
Correlated.
But I mean, I love that he is making these observations that, like, look, I'm going to look for these little bits of variation and look for families.
But we've all seen, like, if you've got a dog, you've watched your dog shake the water off their fur after you wash them, and they get that.
Twitchy.
And horses can, like, shake their fur, their skin, to get horses flies off. Yeah. So the ability to move the skin is very interesting, and the humans have only got a little bit of it left, mm-hmm. just the eyebrows.
So it's also, it's enviable.
Oh, you want to just shake
I
it off
wish I could do that.
Yeah, like, wouldn't it be cool?
Twitch.
Wouldn't it be cool?
Yeah. So there's that he talks about. And he talks about some other rudiment features of our evolutionary past, right? The scars of our ancestry. I didn't know if any of you wanted to talk about some of your favorite stories.
My own ancestral scars?
Yeah. What's your own ancestors? Not psychological scars, Mark. Just it's
hard for me to see any other because, you know, those loom large.
Well, you know, I thought it was really funny. So Darwin talks about this tubercle in our ear, right? The inner, on the outer of ear, there's a little bump that's now called Darwin's tubercle, even though he, in his book, points out that he learned about it by this artist, mm-hmm. right? And this artist, Woolner, this is what I think is interesting. In this chapter, Darwin references artists who have studied the human form so much because they want to capture it in a sculpture or a painting. They notice these little subtle things, like what's this called? The Palmer?
Oh, Palmaris longus, yeah, tendis, tendon, something like that.
It's a tendon. So, dear listener, if you take your thumb and your pinky finger and connect them together and push them together in your wrist, as you look at your wrist, there should be a... There doesn't should be.
There may be.
There may be.
There will likely be.
Likely be a rise of a tendon. But what, 14% of people like you?
Okay. European ancestry, of course.
Right.
So you don't have it?
I don't.
Oh.
So Belinda fails to have it. Flat wrist.
Wow.
Totally flat wrist. But if it pops up like that, that's a tendon that some humans have and some don't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why? What, you know, so what?
Yeah.
Why would Darwin care about that?
So he seems to be making this argument that it was present in an ancestor, and now because it is of no longer of use to us, so he goes back to this use and disuse, which he's used in the past in Origin, to say that it's now fading away, essentially, right? It's this...
a neutral trait.
Yeah, this rudimentary... trait that, because natural selection no longer has a reason to work upon it, it can start kind of fading away in the population. And therefore, you see variation in that some people have it and some people don't.
Because it had to do with grip, right? Like
oh, yeah, that one in particular? Yeah, right.
Right.
But all of these, he's arguing that once upon a time they had a function, they started to not be important to an organism, they didn't use them anymore, natural selection then wouldn't punish you for not having this trait, and therefore it remains variable in the population.
There's also no penalty for having it.
Right. And so like one of the things he kind of struggles with is then, okay, well, why doesn't it just completely go away, right? And so he talks a little bit about... two reasons he argues for why they start to go away, which is compensation and economy of growth. So this idea that these structures are costly at some level to make, and therefore that is why they should go away if they no longer have a purpose. But if they go away to the point where they no longer have a cost, but they still kind of hang around, you can't completely eliminate it.
Because there's no
penalty.
No penalty.
Right. It has been interesting, though, as a... you know, work has come out to really look at more of the mechanism of loss. So I'm thinking of blind cavefish, the Mexican blind cavefish. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's a similar idea of, oh, well, they lose their eyes because they don't need them. But why have they all lost them? You know, there's been some really beautiful works down to the genetics showing that they actually are, you know, putting that energy or gene products instead into other features, you know, smell, et cetera, that could be more helpful for that particular niche.
So, yeah, limited amount of resources. Don't put it in eyes that don't give you anything.
Right.
Right. And this weird little tendon, now some plastic surgeons use that tendon to do reconstructive surgery because they can remove it, like you were saying, Sarah, there's no cost of not having it. It's kind of weird that, but now there's an advantage. I can harvest it and use it if you happen to destroy another tendon somewhere else in your body. Yeah. But it is one of those weird kind of traits that Darwin sort of points out to us. And the other one is this thing that on his ear we started to talk about that also became Darwin's tubercle, which is a little bump on the outer outer edge of your ear. Our ears are really weird.
Yeah.
Have you actually thought about your ear?
Yes.
Sarah says yes.
Like, I have weird things where I have, like, this one has a flap.
Oh, yeah. You don't have symmetry in your ears.
And all of my female cousins on one side have the same thing.
No, that's so cool.
Only the female cousins.
My mother's ears, she doesn't have the part that folds down.
What?
So she looks like she's got these little elf ears.
Ooh.
It's weird.
See?
I didn't get
like,
that.
But this seems to fit, you know, Darwin's vestigial trait, right? Like, you should have a lot of variation where there's not a cost to that kind of variation, right?
And we don't think about our ears, but, you know, is there adaptive value? Is it actually collecting sound and channeling it to our head or to our
Yeah, that was the one where I felt like, yeah, Darwin in his arguments talks about, oh, maybe this was a thing once we got in trees and you can maybe 3D locate things. So I was like, yeah. So this one feels a little bit of a just-so story. But
we can't move our ears like other mammals can, like dogs and
except for Sarah.
Cows. Right. Oh, yeah, except for Sarah. Right, you primitive you.
But yes. it does, to a certain extent, I mean, serve as a bit of a collector mechanism, mm-hmm. right, for sound waves. If you,
I don't know.
If you did not have the pinna, right, this outside part of your ear.
Are you saying that helps channel sound?
It does. It has to. I'm assuming. Well, okay. So maybe I'm not.
Cut your ear off. Let's find out.
Oh, yeah.
This is Picasso. Let's be a Picasso and see. Yeah.
I think you saw it too, James, the Lowe and Cohen article from 2016 that kind of goes into the tubercle. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a few things where they were kind of, you know, established. Yeah, there seems to be a genetic component that a lot of times twins possess them, but they also found plenty of cases of mixed twins where one twin has it and one twin doesn't for identical twins, right? Mm-hmm. And also that it seems to vary based on ontogeny, like not just like birth on. I mean, like old men have them more frequently than young people.
Oh, so it changes
in general.
As you
so sex
age.
And age, right, both seem to change the expression of it. Like you can grow a tubercle later in life, essentially.
Oh my God, that's gonna be growth. Looking in the mirror every morning.
Right. Yeah. Wait to get your tubercle. You know you've arrived.
Well, and like we were talking about, the older you get, more like likely you're getting hairs growing from
hair
your
cancer.
Ears.
Yeah.
Well,
the funny thing is that there's a lot of research. The reason those researchers looked at it was because they wanted to use it as a way to identify you, like fingerprints. Like ear structure becomes a way to distinctly identify an individual. So our ear shape, but then Sarah, right side Sarah is totally different from left side
exactly.
Sarah.
Exactly. So better check the right one. Yeah.
But there is huge variation in our ear structure, and this weird fold, Darwin argues, is a ancestral version of our ears being much longer.
And pointed.
Pointed, yeah. Elvin.
And that was the one where I thought, like, once again, I thought the point thing was kind of a stretch personally. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if what you thought about it, Belinda. The one thing that, like, the only thing I found was that why it might form is an unequal turning of the helix, which is that part of your ear in the fetus that would lead to that.
Oh, that's really, that makes a lot of sense. It seems like also, I mean, even position in the uterus. Right, and especially if there's more than one. That
wait, are you saying like every morning I wake up, the side of my head, the right side, it's got, because I bury it in the pillow and I'm going to be eventually bald on the right side of my head.
Except for I'm saying like when you're in the womb.
Right, I'm pushing as a womb, a fetus.
Yeah. Right, and as it's developing.
Changing.
Right, and I mean you do
but that's
all
also,
that.
That's why I sleep on my right side Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
Oh,
and my left side Tuesday.
That's very smart.
Yeah. Smart.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that the why they make you change directions on the track? Each one leg doesn't get stronger. I'm
Sarah?
Just throwing
maybe.
It out there.
Yeah, I mean, they just say it's about this like unequal turning in the helix during development will determine whether you have the tubercle or not. And so like, it's hard for me, it's more of a stretch to be like, oh, it's the point on the top of the ear that's now on the inside side lower.
But if that's the case, it wouldn't be hereditary, right? It's just a feature
of
Darwin.
Right,
and
that's the thing in that paper. I actually thought it was interesting because to me it suggested there's not a strong heritable component to it, actually.
Yeah.
So to me, that was a weaker vestigial trait, you know, he had better maybe examples of vestigial traits. And you know, I feel like we have to talk about the classic one, right, which is the appendix.
Yes.
That we all think of the appendix as this vestigial trait that just, like, blows up on you and you got to cut it out, right?
Like, show up in the hospital at some point in your life with its...
Right.
And annoyed.
And now, like, the evidence seems to be going more on the side of it's not vestigial, in fact, because it is this kind of seed colony for gut microbiota when you have these massive... GI events that Belinda and I have experienced recently.
What brought that on?
I don't know,
we
but
don't
we
know.
Both had it.
It was the first week of school, and we both...
Oh. So they're synchronized, too.
Yeah, exactly. We were. We called each other up.
Yeah. Like, what's the
oh, my God.
But so when I was going into this stuff on the appendix, because I think we're all kind of like familiar with this idea now, like, even in popular culture, that maybe the appendix is, actually has a function. Mm-hmm. Two things that I found interesting. One is, like, there's this argument that the appendix is this kind of, you know, devolved, this, you know, this vestigial structure of the cecum, which is for, you know, gut fermentation, right? And so that's where you hold these things, especially like these herbivores that are eating a lot of, you know,
plant material,
yeah, herbs. Fiber.
Yeah.
And so you can look, though, even within primates to see that the size of their cecum varies on the based on their diet. So, for example, howler monkeys who eat just pretty much leaves versus spider monkeys who mostly forage on fruit, like, they have huge differences in the size of their cecums, right? Hmm. And then new evidence seems to suggest that the appendix actually evolved before the cecum.
Wow.
Right? So that the ancestral state was not to have this thing that's doing hindgut fermentation. Instead, it maybe was this repopulating thing that held gut microbiota, and that the cecum evolved from that. So flipping it completely the other direction, instead of it being this vestigial trait, it actually maybe arose as the thing that is the appendix, and later in certain lineages grew to be this cecum thing.
That's so cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
See, every single one of these examples, we could all dig into the literature and have so much fun with it.
Exactly.
And he does talk about rudimentary structures in non-humans, like the cows having incisor teeth that are still buried in their gums.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think, Belinda, there's evidence that, like, chickens have teeth genes, right? But they don't express them.
Yeah.
You can turn them on, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. The really crazy experiment where... some scientists embedded little beads that had one of the BMP genes, I can't remember which one, into the jaws of chicks, and they actually grew these teeth. And they're crazy if you look at it. I know, I don't think this is, I mean, I've looked back over this and it doesn't work all the time. Mm-hmm. It seems they got kind of lucky. But it's almost like a molar. I mean, it's crazy. So, yeah, I mean, basically...
But if we look at the genetic sequence, the DNA sequence of a chicken or bird, do we see genes that code for what we think are teeth?
Oh, yeah. Well, and you know, the thing is most of our genes have more than one function.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
So
there's not a teeth gene?
Right, exactly, exactly. So it usually, in that case, would be a change in expression. And so it's still expressed wherever else it needs to be, but maybe it's turned off. Yeah, in this one particular region. But then if you have a mutation that turns expression on... Right, and that just goes back to the early Homeobox Drosophila mutations, where they had legs coming out of their antennae places because they were just expressing it in the wrong place.
Hopeful monsters.
Yes. That, right. Those pictures were shown on X-Files, which is pretty amazing. Huh? Yeah.
All right, so let me ask you guys this. You read this chapter. Did Darwin... Was he successful in getting the reader to believe humans are just another, you know, brick on the wall, right? We're just another animal, and we're actually not anything special. We're just a variation on the theme.
Yeah, I mean, I think for being 150 years later, a huge amount of it holds up still. Like, the broad, not the details, but, like, the broad ideas, the... Mm-hmm. The homology, the vestigial traits, the developmental similarities.
Looking at families.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think once again, it's you're talking about, well, who's the target audience? There's people who, no matter what evidence you give, they're not going
to
think that it's strong.
Even 150 years later.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So.
So it worked for you. You thought. I mean.
It's just hard to say. I mean, I appreciated it. But that's what I feel like I can say. I appreciate that he was being meticulous and trying to come up with examples that fit his postulates of natural selection.
Mark, what do you think?
Sure, I'm interested. Actually, I was just now looking at...
Are you just now reading the book?
No, no. So where it's going in the next chapter. What's coming up. And,
oh, yeah. I'm curious.
Yeah, I am curious as to where this goes. But yes, of course. I mean, I just hit my... Did you hear that?
Totally heard that.
Yeah, okay. No.
I hear everything.
But yes, you know, these are fundamental arguments that we've heard in other places since Darwin. I mean, you know, it comes from Darwin, but yeah.
He also, we didn't cover, he does very briefly mention Neoteny, right, with the orangutans. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Refresh our memory of that word, Neoteny.
Right, so it's the idea of
Neoteny.
retaining juvenile features right into adulthood,
right.
Which is a big idea about human evolution. And once again, I can't remember how much he's talked about that in the past, or I don't even know how much he talks about it, but I did pull that out of this reading.
So, first chapter, he throws a bunch of ammunition on this idea. Look, humans, you're not that special.
Right.
You are just a modified animal.
But I don't know. He's not making this entire case just from the first chapter.
No.
Right? Okay.
Well, here's what's interesting. So, I think this chapter is trying to go physically. Mm-hmm. You are just like an animal.
Right.
The question is going to be where he's going to go mentally. Right.
Right. And that certainly pops up as I just, again, kind of peruse the...
we're only at page 43 of 600.
Yeah, I know. And,
let's
see where this goes. But yeah, in these extra subtitles, he talks about mind and function. And,
yeah. So chapter 2 is on the manner of development of man from some lower form, which sounds very similar to chapter 1.
Right. I know, that's what I was going to say. You said that embryos were done, but development, do they mean development is more evolution?
Yeah.
You might have to come back next time.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah, so the first chapter is the evidence of the descent of man. The second chapter is on the manner of development from man.
All right. Well, we look forward to seeing you guys next month or hearing... we don't see or hear you. I don't know what we do. We just put it out there.
We scream
into the void. But yeah, don't forget to. There's no bell to ring. There's no. There's no. Nothing. I was gonna think there's no Patreon to patronize or whatever.
Patronize, yeah.
Patronize. Yeah, that's it.
Like us and make a comment and give us a 5-star rating.
We should do that.
We on Yelp? We should get on Yelp.
No,
have you heard of this Yelp? Yelp.com.
We are on discoveringdarwin.blogspot.com, where you can actually see additional information.
Oh, good. Yes.
Yeah, we have that. And Sarah, we have a Facebook page that is out there.
And we have a Twitter that I occasionally throw.
There you go.
Oh, the tweeters.
And on the discoveringdarwin.blogspot.com, you can actually comment, and we do encourage you to do so. But for now, thank you for listening to us. Bye-bye.
Bye.
It's been fun.
Bye.
I enjoy this every time.